Hello, I'm Paul Yeager, and welcome to the MTOM Show podcast. We're on location today at the Griffune Farm in Polk County, Iowa, where they held two dignitaries, two secretaries of agriculture, one from the United States and one from Mexico. Now, USMCA was a big topic in the last administration. Now, the current administration is trying to sort things out and keep those relationships with both Canada and Mexico. On the farm visit, the Secretary of Agriculture from Mexico talked about buying U.S. corn. We get into a discussion with Tom Vilsack, who is back as head of USDA, about what he is seeing and finding in this next era of Washington, D.C., and what political stomachs they're willing to take in the Biden administration. Today, we're going to cover trade. We'll talk about China, new markets, as well as that Canadian and Mexican market. Then we'll also kind of diverge into discussing the meat industry, how he was just on Capitol Hill last week having a conversation with Congress. And we'll then also cover the plight of the American worker. That is this installment of the MTOM Show podcast. If you have any feedback, hit me up at paul.yeager@iowapbs.org or send us an email at markettomarket@iowapbs.org. Now, our sit-down conversation with the United States Department of Agriculture's head and secretary, Tom Vilsack. Secretary Vilsack, you're here in Iowa. You're playing tour guide a little bit. Why is it important to have a good relationship with Mexico?
Well, it's important to have a good relationship, first and foremost, with my counterpart in Mexico, because you have to have the ability to pick up the phone or visit face-to-face and have frank and trusted conversation. So that relationship becomes important to build. I actually have a relationship with Secretary Villalobos for some time, so it's been a little bit easier with him. It's important for the U.S.-Mexico relationship because so much of what we trade, so much of what we sell overseas, if you will, in our export, one of our number top three markets is Mexico for many of our products. In some cases, it's our number one market. So it's important, obviously, to make sure that we continue to have a good relationship. We continue to identify the problem areas in the relationship and try to work through them.
USMCA was, you were familiar with NAFTA from your previous time. USMCA comes along. That was a big goal of the previous administration. How have you sorted through some of those changes and conversations you've had with Mexico? And you can throw in your Canadian counterparts, too.
Well, I think the conversation with Mexico has been a little bit easier as it relates to USMCA because the problems we have there, I think we can work through. For example, while it is accurate that Mexico has taken a pretty hard line in terms of genetically engineered crops that are grown in Mexico, it has not prevented that country from continuing to import into the country corn that's grown here in the U.S. using GMO GE technology. Our friends in Canada, it's a little different situation. One of the principal reasons why Congress voted in favor of the USMCA from an agricultural perspective was the belief that Canada would in fact open up its market for U.S. dairy. We are still having conversations with our Canadian friends about that. And we have actually triggered the consultation process or begun the consultation process that is provided for in the USMCA when you have a difficulty or a disagreement that's not getting worked through. So that's one of the benefits of USMCA, that there's actually a mechanism for putting something on the table when you have a disagreement with your trading partner. That's really important. Our hope is that we get a resolution. Obviously, there was an election in Canada, and that made a difference in terms of people's attitudes, but hopefully we're now in a position for Canada to understand that we are very serious about that market access and that we expect to see it.
Trade's incredibly important on many aspects. Last week, the market seemed to yawn when it was announced that Mexico bought a bunch of U.S. corn. Why does that need to be more of an importance when Mexico is buying U.S. corn?
Well, it's important for us to have diversified market opportunities. And I think there's a lot of interest and a lot of focus on China because that's a very large purchaser and has been recently. Obviously, during the trade war, that was not the case, and commodity prices reflected that. But I think the best way we can provide assistance and help for our farmers is to make sure we have multiple markets. And some markets will be small, some markets will be large. Mexico happens to be a large market. We want to preserve that. It's a convenient market, obviously, the transportation expense. It's one of the reasons why we have a competitive edge in that market. We want to maintain that. But we can't be satisfied with just that market. We have to look for other opportunities. China is obviously one of those. But I think we even have to go deeper and further. I think we have to continue to look for ways in which we can diversify, especially within Southeast Asia, because I think there are enormous opportunities there. And I think we need to begin thinking about the strategy as it relates to Africa, because there's going to be a significant increase in population in that continent, and it's going to be important for us to be competitive.
Farmers for Free Trade last week were asking you to look at other markets, specifically in Asia. Is China a country you can't even have a conversation with right now?
No, I've had several conversations with my counterpart in China. It's not that you can't have a conversation. It's that there are so many layers to the Chinese relationship. The complexity of that relationship is pretty significant. And at any point in time, one of those layers could impact and affect every other layer. Let me give you an example. There could be a situation with Taiwan. There could be a situation in the South China Sea. There could be a situation in Hong Kong. There could be a situation in which minorities in China are being oppressed. All of that, any of that, could potentially trigger a reaction that leads to a change of decisions by the Chinese government in terms of purchases that are being made. We saw during the course of the trade war that the Chinese government can make decisions fairly quickly to start or to stop trade. And so in order for us to be more confident in a long-term trading strategy, we need to make sure we have multiple markets so that if at some point in time, for whatever reason, that relationship changes or is altered, we're in a position to pivot so that we don't see the dramatic drop in commodity prices that we experienced during the trade war.
U.S. Trade Ambassador Lighthizer took a different approach to China than what your trade rep under the Obama administration had taken with China. And now Catherine Tai last week kind of said, we're going to keep some of the Trump-era tariffs in place. What have you noticed in changes from your last service, the 4 years you were out, and now your first year back in?
Well, I think Ambassador Tai understands the significance of relationships, and I think she wants to be able to establish a relationship with her counterpart in China, similar to what I have with Secretary Villalobos here in Mexico. The ability to be able to talk frankly and honestly and openly about whatever differences we may have. I think she is absolutely right in spending the time now in pointing out to China that they made certain promises in the Phase One trade agreement. They made promises concerning biotechnology. They made promises concerning a variety of issues and the sanitary and phytosanitary system. They did a pretty good job, but they didn't do a perfect job. They made 57 commitments. They've gone through with 50 of them, but there's still seven big ones left. She also pointed out that they made purchasing commitments. And while they have seriously and significantly increased purchases, they're still not at the level that they promised to be. So I think it's appropriate for her to start the conversation with a with a pesky fly.
Yeah.
With essentially saying to China, look, before we can have conversations about the future, about the nature of this relationship, we got to make sure that we're following through on the promises we made. If not, that creates a level of uncertainty about the relationship. So it'll be interesting to see how China reacts to that first step. So I appreciate she taking that step. I appreciate she taking a hard line, which is live up to your promises. If they live up, that means $5 billion more of agricultural products from the U.S. going to China than before, and that obviously will be helpful.
China is a nonstop news event for those that follow trade. And have you read anything differently from previous services in relationships? Are the Chinese treating you differently?
Well, I had a very good relationship with my counterpart in China, and he has since left. But I think he has been able to convey to his successor that I'm somebody that will have an honest conversation with him, somebody that will speak frankly and honestly. And I think that's important. I've had good conversations so far with my counterpart there, and I would expect we'll continue to have those conversations.
Last week, your office released some water infrastructure improvements and infrastructure improvements specifically in Iowa. I want to ask about just one thing as a base point. Ashton, Iowa, they got a $1 million loan, a $947,000 grant for water improvements. Why are those important to have those, especially we're in the middle of major drought in western Iowa and the West and into Canada?
Well, there are a variety of different ways in which we provide assistance in terms of water. In some cases, we are basically creating access to water. In some cases, we're dealing with a wastewater treatment system or drainage system, or we may be dealing with a stormwater system. All of this is important in terms of quality of life, in terms of the ability of communities to attract businesses to the community, the ability of the community to service the needs of their citizens, the ability to expand population, the ability to ensure safe drinking water. All of that is tied into our water programs. And we are basically the provider, if you will, of resources for rural water. So it may very well be access. So you didn't have access to clean drinking water, now you do. It could be that your wastewater treatment facility is antiquated, now you get to modernize it. It may be that your streets flood every time there's just a drop of rain, now that's not the case, people's basements are protected, and you've basically created a better quality of life. It's a combination of many of those things in all those grants.
You just a minute ago talked about relationships with China. You have relationships with the United Auto Workers. They're striking against John Deere, major manufacturer in this country. They had tried to send work to other countries. They're back in the United States. You're going to go talk to some of those picketers after we get done here. What's that conversation like with those two groups? Are they two different messages?
Not necessarily. The message both the union and to Deere officials, if we have conversations with folks, is to simply, look, you guys understand and appreciate that farmers, in particular in Iowa, are and particularly in the Midwest and across the country, are dependent on the equipment and parts that you all make. And so to the extent that you can get your issues resolved in a fair and equitable way for everyone, we would encourage that. I'm speaking to the UAW folks in large part because of a relationship. When you run for office, there are people that are for you, and there are people who aren't for you. And oftentimes when you're running, and particularly if you're running from behind, and you're fortunate enough, as I was, to be elected governor after being behind for most of my 1998 campaign, you kind of remember the people that were with you when nobody else was. Well, those folks at the UAW were very supportive of me during my run for governor. And so you just don't want to forget the people that that got you there, just in the same way that I don't want to forget the people of Mount Pleasant who gave me an opportunity to be a mayor, or the people of Iowa who allowed me the opportunity and honor to be a governor for 8 years. I wouldn't have the current job I have but for all of those folks, and you just don't want to forget them.
The American worker in the food system right now has gone through many different changes in the last year and a half since COVID. Meatpacking industry has said they can't get enough workers in. Trucking industry, we don't have enough drivers. Manufacturing plants, we don't have enough workers. Is this anything to do with NAFTA offshoots from years ago? Is this a worker training issue? What are we seeing come to a head other than simple supply and demand?
Well, I think there was a major disruption from the pandemic. I mean, look at it. We shut down a substantial portion of the economy of the country. As a result of the pandemic, we've unfortunately and tragically lost hundreds of thousands of our fellow citizens, and millions of them have been sick. There has been a major disruption, and it causes, I think, a lot of soul searching on the part of a lot of folks. And there may very well be people that were contemplating retirement or contemplating a change in opportunity before the pandemic, and maybe this basically accelerated their timeline. At the end of the day, what you have to do in a disruption is you basically have to figure out strategies to cope and to deal with the disruption until you get to a more stable and secure place. I think it does emphasize the need in this country to continue to look for ways in which we can honor those who not only work with their head, but also with their hands. And if there's any long-term issue here, I think it's the fact that for far too long, we didn't understand or appreciate all those folks who work with their hands. And I'll give you an example in USDA. We send young men and women into our forests that are burning at incredibly hot temperatures. And we were paying those folks $13 an hour. And some of them were temporary workers. And some of them, because they were temporary and because they have to move from fire to fire, didn't have a place to stay, so they stayed in their car while they were fighting the fire. Now, we've got work to do to basically say, wait a second, let's step back here and recognize what these folks do for us. They protect our homes, they protect our lives, they protect our forests, they protect our communities. And maybe we ought to have a compensation system that reflects the risk and reflects the importance of their work. And maybe we should figure out a way in which they could have a hot shower every night in a place where they got a decent bed. And so we're working on improving the compensation for these farmers, and we're working with a number of entities to try to figure out transitional housing, if you will, so that they are respected for the work that they do. And I think that's probably true across a lot of professions and occupations where people work with their hands, they do manual. We got to understand they are incredibly important to an economy, and they need to be valued.
The budget process is always a challenge, but in the firefighting business, especially in the West, a lot of the money gets eaten up in fighting, and none of the forest cleanup can happen. Is there any hope of trying to be able to shift some money from other areas because of the environmental concerns? And the president has a strong environmental agenda.
Well, there's something more than hope. There's actual investment. Previous administration didn't fully utilize the fire fix that Congress had enacted that would provide for additional resources for fighting the fires. We are using that resource, and we believe that there will be sufficient resources to fight the fires and at the same time not have to rob Peter to pay Paul. Having said that, the president's budget for next year contains a significant increase in the firefighting budget, which guarantees that we won't be robbing Peter to pay Paul, and we'll be able to use those resources for the specific purpose for which they were intended. And I believe that when Congress passes the reconciliation bill and the infrastructure bill, that additional resources are going to be made available. So over a period of time, and it will take time, Paul, this is a situation where we didn't get into this mess overnight. We're not going to get out of it overnight. We're going to have a long-term commitment to better forest management, reforestation. That's going to take resources, a significantly greater amount of resources. It's also going to take more resources for treatment so that we are preventing these mega fires. We know from our experience, even with the recent fires, the Calder fire in California, because we had advanced treatment prior to that fire, we were able to save South Tahoe from more destruction. So we need to do much, much more of that. That requires resources. I think those resources are coming.
Last subject. Last week you were in Congress talking about the meatpacking industry. Kind of talked a little bit about the worker earlier. What's this administration going to be able to do for, is there a stomach politically to try to break up big companies? You talk about competition earlier at the event. There's been programs to help smaller processors. Is this administration looking at more of that help or more of a breakup of these large players?
Well, our focus right now is on capacity and competition, and I think they go hand in hand. If you expand capacity, you're also going to expand competition. Well, how do you do that? Well, the first thing you do is you take a look at your existing processing capacity, your existing processing plants, and ask the question, are there ways in which you can expand? Are there ways in which you can create new market opportunities? The answer is yes and yes. So we're providing resources in the form of grants and loans to be able to expand, to change market opportunities, to expand market opportunities. Is there a way of reducing the cost for existing facilities so they stay in business? Answer, yes. We're providing resources to reduce the cost of inspection. But is there also a way in which we can use resources to expand new capacity or to build on significantly to existing capacity? And the answer to those questions is yes. And we're doing all of that. And I think we want to see how that works. And I believe that over the course of the next year or so, you're going to begin to see investments being made, processing being expanded. And what this is going to do is it creates competition, but it also creates resiliency. And part of the challenge here that we found with having too few processing facilities, when one shuts down, it creates chaos in the market, disrupts the market. We've got to have more capacity. We have to have the ability to shift, because this is the last disruption that we're going to be faced with. It may be drought, it may be fire, it may be COVID, it may be something else, but we know that these disruptions are going to occur. So the focus now is on not just great efficiency and productivity, but also on resiliency. And with resiliency, it means expanded capacity, and we're investing in expanded capacity. We're also making sure that we strengthen the rules and laws governing the relationship between the producers and the packers, right? There may be circumstances and situations in some industries where the playing field's not quite level, and that's why we get into the Packers and Stockyards Act. It may also be that we need to have better discovery. We better have understanding of what the price actually is. There's so few cash transactions that it sometimes you begin to wonder whether or not the price that you're being quoted is really the price it should be quoted. So more price discovery. So a variety of things that need to be done and are being done.
If only another 2 days, we'd get into price discovery for the rest of the conversation. Secretary Vilsack, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
My thanks to Tom Vilsack for sitting for those questions. Again, if you have any feedback, hit us up, markettomarket@iowapbs.org. Like, share, subscribe. Every new episode comes out on a Tuesday. We'll see you next time. Thanks for watching.